Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Dave Schrader. Big congratulations going out to the New England Patriots and the Arizona Cardinals for their defeats today. Very well done. We've got a great show for you. If you have been watching anything in pop culture right now, there is a documentary series on Netflix that has exploded. Making a Murderer. It's become a national obsession. It's a riveting, visually stunning masterpiece of documentary filmmaking. It's also a terrifying tale of true crime and a possible double miscarriage of justice. If you've watched any of the documentary yourself or even heard some of the recaps on the news, it's a chilling story. Joining me this evening, we're going to talk with three different people that will have different sides of the story and perspectives to share. Making a Murderer recounts the story of Stephen Avery, a man who was imprisoned for years for the sexual assault and attempted murder of a Wisconsin woman. Avery was later exonerated, only to be subsequently convicted of the murder of Teresa Halbeck. And before the popularity of that Netflix series, true crime researcher Michael Griesbach wrote extensively about the case. He's joining me for the first 2 hours of the show as we discuss his book. We discuss both cases, the ins and outs, the goods, the bads, and the reality of the story. Then in the third hour, Michael and I will be joined by journalist Dan O'Donnell, who reports on the evidence that convinced him Avery is guilty of killing Halbeck. And then in the last hour, retired police detective John Cameron is going to reveal how the most notorious serial killer you've never heard of, Edward Wayne Edwards, may be tied to the Avery case. There's a lot to explore this evening, so buckle up, hold tight. We've got that coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the idea of true crime. What gets into people's heads that makes them think that they can get away with murder? Or these massive, insane crimes that they involve themselves in. I've watched documentaries, read books voraciously. I'm very interested in the psychological dynamic and the legal system. And I'll tell you, for all of the terrifying true crime stories I've read, the ones that really impact me are the ones where there is a miscarriage of justice involved, not just for the victims, but possibly for the perpetrators, for the people that are put away. According to the Innocence Project, there's around 200 inmates in every state that are being held and convicted of a crime they did not commit. 200 per state. That's a lot of innocent people sitting behind bars for crimes that they were not involved in. How can that happen in 2015, the 21st century? How can we still get it wrong? I mean, the court systems and the law, they're set up to help us. They're set up to be there to hold our hands and protect us. They're the mommy and the daddy to make sure that we're safe. But there's a huge failing in the system, in the justice system. Michael Griesbach is a prosecuting attorney in the Wisconsin county where the events recounted in his book occurred. He wrote The Innocent Killer to challenge the system, to find out if we still believe in the long-cherished principle of American jurisprudence. It's better to let 100 guilty prisoners go free than it is to convict one who is innocent. Griesbach hopes to leave readers better informed about the inner workings of the criminal justice system and more concerned about those whose lives it deeply affects. He lives in East Central Wisconsin, along with his wife Jody and their four children. He's the author of the book, The Innocent Killer, which talks about the Stephen Avery case in depth. Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dave. It's great to be here.
Man, this is a crazy story. You and I talked on my show about 6 months ago about your book and about this case. Did you have any idea that it was going to explode like it has and become such a linchpin in pop culture right now with this documentary series?
I don't think anybody did, not even the filmmakers or the creators of this series. You know, they did this about 8 years ago. And they followed this case very carefully for the whole 2 years while it was pending. And I really, at that time, because I was interviewed by them, they had no idea what was going to become of it. They were hoping to get it out there to somebody. And I'm pretty sure it died after a while because years went by and I hadn't heard back from them until maybe 6 months ago. They let me know that Netflix took it on. And then the rest is history. I mean, it's amazing, like you said. I mean, there's legions of Netflix viewers out there who are, I think obsessed is not too strong of a word for it, Dave.
Obsessed and fascinated by the story. And I think the reason why is because it just shows how vulnerable all of us are to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and have our fates put in the hands of the wrong people. I don't want this, and I'm sure you don't, as any of our guests that will come on tonight, don't want this to be a harsh look at police officers and the criminal justice system everywhere. That isn't the case. But when it fails, it seems to fail in an epic way, Michael. And in this Stephen Avery case, at least in the initial case, it failed miserably and put away a man in the face of lots of other evidence proving his innocence, put him away for 18 years. And I think that's what fascinates so many of these people, don't you, that this is what's going on and this is what's possible?
This is exactly what fascinates people, and it both fascinated and upset me. I mean, these were my predecessors that were here, the district attorney and the prosecutor at the time. And miscarriage of justice, in a way, doesn't begin to describe it. This was not one of those sort of accidental or even overly zealous prosecutorial cases where someone's wrongly convicted. It wasn't just a false identification, although it involved that. But it was much worse. I mean, this was more of a knowing, close to intentional, if not intentional, wrongful conviction of an innocent man, though he be Stephen Avery. It doesn't matter who he is. And that injustice, as I wrote in the epilogue of the book, it festered for year after year after year. You know, with one thing or the next that happened after that, including the brutal rape of a woman in Green Bay, 10 years after Mr. Avery was wrongly convicted, by the real assailant, you know, left free to roam the streets. They say for every wrongful conviction, the real assailant goes free. So there you have one, would have been one less victim of a violent crime had the police and the prosecutor done their job in the first case.
And the real sad fact, the sad fact of that case too, Michael, is the fact that in a lot of rape cases, women do not come forward because of embarrassment, humiliation, and the fact that in a lot of ways they are made to feel responsible for that situation, which is heartbreaking. So how many other cases took place that this criminal actually perpetrated in that 10 years that have not come to light?
Yeah, we'll never know. And we do know how bad the one he committed in Green Bay was. I mean, the guy is still in prison, and that was 1995. And I have contacted them to hopefully keep him for life in prison because under Wisconsin's sex predator law, even though he wasn't convicted of the case for which Mr. Avery was wrongly convicted in 1985, this guy was a monster, and everyone knows he did it. We couldn't charge him because of statute of limitations issues, because it was an attempted murder and a sex assault, not a murder. So there is a statute of limitations, but that doesn't mean the authorities haven't been told here in Wisconsin, the Department of Corrections, exactly what he did on that beach that fateful day back in 1985. So I hope they'll keep him past his MR date, which is still 10 years away.
Well, let's bring people up to date. There are many people that aren't watching this, believe it or not. It's hard to believe at this point. It's covered on every news station, every cable outlet. It seems this is the story du jour. Let's bring up the audience to date. Tell me a little bit about Stephen Avery and the Avery family and who they are, what they were in Wisconsin.
Sure. So we live in now famous Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, which despite how it seems on Netflix, it's not always, you know, 10 below and 5-6 feet of snow. And it's not just full of junkyards. It's a gorgeous area here, to tell you the truth. It's wonderful. It's right on Lake Michigan. The Averys live, the family live on a compound or of different residences out on this business of theirs, the Avery Salvage Yard. There's probably three or four buildings, maybe five, one of which Stephen Avery lived in when the final crime occurred. That really is what's going on here as far as the subject of all this. And that's about 12 miles north of Manitowoc. Manitowoc itself, the city, is a city of about 35,000 people. There's another adjoining city, Two Rivers, that puts it up to about 50,000 people. So it's a, you know, mid-sized Midwestern city. But the Avery Salvage Yard is out in the country, and the Averys have had that salvage yard. It's actually a decent business, and they are a close-knit, hard-working family. I got to know that as I researched this book. But they're also a family that is very troubled in many ways, and it was known, especially to law enforcement, what the Averys were about. And so that really is much of what started Stephen Avery's problems, that knowledge by law enforcement of the Avery clan back in 1985 when he was wrongly accused and then wrongly convicted of this crime. A real brief wrap-up from there for your audience, those who haven't heard it, is in 1985 Stephen Avery was arrested and convicted of this brutal crime in its own right, a vicious assault of a woman named Penny Burnson. Now, Penny actually wrote a postscript for my book, and Penny's another victim of this case. You were talking about it already, Dave. You know, victims of sex assaults, they not only go through the victimhood of the incident. Obviously, there's nothing worse for a woman to go through other than death. Murder, and Penny was close to being murdered. We can describe that later, but here she was in 1985, the victim of this horrendous, horrible, horrific crime, and then she's the victim of the criminal justice system as that case unfolded, because she was manipulated into picking the wrong person. And soon after the police knew the real person, they hid things from her, even though she doubted who was her assailant. That didn't matter to them. They didn't want to back up and dismiss and start over against the guy who they knew was the right assailant. So Penny's the victim of that original wrongful conviction. Not as bad as Mr. Avery's the victim, 18 years in prison. But she's the second victim. And then, of course, the wrongful conviction occurs, and I'm sure we'll get into great detail about that. And then he sits for 18 years in a Wisconsin state prison until 2003, when DNA, the wonderful technological advancements in science really is what freed Mr. Avery. And, of course, that's the same advancement in science that convicts many people today, too, as well as acquits them and shows they didn't do it. But here Mr. Avery gets out in 2003 he's a celebrity in the state of Wisconsin. He was the first exonerated individual by the Wisconsin Innocence Project, and it was a big deal. I got personally involved at that point as a prosecutor because I got the call along with my boss from the crime lab indicating the DNA match to a different person. And we wanted to assure ourselves that Mr. Avery, just because of one DNA hit on a hair, a single hair. And the last shred of evidence in the first Avery case came back to somebody else. We weren't going to release him on the strength of just that until we assured ourselves, really by spending a night and the next day going through boxes of evidence, at which time I think is the genesis of why I wrote this book. I became disgusted by what my predecessors had done. It became painfully obvious that they knew who the real assailant was within a couple days of arresting the wrong one, but they didn't care.
How do you, when you talk about that, you're in the criminal justice system. You find out that not only did they know, but then they concealed, they conspired, and they kept an innocent man in prison for 18 years. And then you were walking the halls with these men, with these people, and dealing with the judicial system on a regular basis, only to have this come out and in such glaring detail how badly the police, the law, the judge, the court systems failed Stephen Avery in that case. What is that like for you?
Well, it was, I'm thinking back to it right now. It was just, is this real? Did they really do this? Now, I will say this, fortunately, because I don't know how I would have dealt with it if they were still there. The main players had moved on. Dennis Vogel, the district attorney, had retired or left Manitowoc shortly after the wrongful conviction itself, 15 years earlier, to a law firm in Madison, Wisconsin. The sheriff, who I knew, but was then retired, Tom Kucerek, was done by that time, thank goodness, because I don't know that I could have stayed. And the other way I dealt with it is we took it to the Attorney General's office. You know, it's a sickening feeling, a knowing feeling that everything we're hearing as a few days go by, which we could get into, not just the transcripts, but new information, this sickening feeling that someone else has to look at this. We've got to get this outside our office. So we took it to Madison, the Wisconsin Attorney General's office. That's a great question, one I really haven't thought much of, because had they still been there, I'm not sure what I would have done. I couldn't stand the idea of them not being held accountable. How could I prosecute cases that the sheriff was involved in after that? Although I will say he personally did not involve himself with prosecutions or investigations other than this one, because he knew the Bernsons, and that was part of the problem here. He should never have been involved in the first place.
Right, which to me sounds strange. You would think the sheriff is the lead law official. Why wouldn't the sheriff get involved in a major crime like this, especially to an upstanding, well-known citizen in the town? And it seemed like in the documentary they were playing that up, that, oh, he really shouldn't have been involved in this case. Maybe I have a misunderstanding or misconception of what it is to be the sheriff, but I thought he's the leader. He's the one that should be leading the charge for justice.
Well, I think it depends on the size of the town. You know, a small town sheriff that only has maybe 10 or even 15 officers, I think would want to lead the charge. This is, there's probably 50, 60, now maybe 70 employees at the Sheriff's Department, because it is a city of about 50,000 people. So once you get to that level, and you know how bureaucracy is and administrative duties, it's pretty rare, every sheriff since then, and I think police agencies too, anyone with about that size population, the top guy, even the next two top folks, they don't get too much, they don't do too much in actual investigations, even high-profile ones. And frankly, they're not as good at it. You know, they've got detectives that know better and are trained better. They're pretty much administrators, and that's what Sheriff Kucerek was.
You hear this story, you've written this book, you've fleshed out the story for people in detail of the case of Stephen Avery, the very first case, the sexual attack and physical abuse of this woman. And he claimed through the entire thing that he was innocent. And I thought what was so fascinating about the case, and especially when you watch the documentary, is this guy was put away for a heinous crime. And when he's released, he's still pretty upbeat about everything. You would think after 18 years, this man would have been broken down and a shell of who he was. But he was smiling, and he was happy, and he was very outgoing. And I understand he has played up a lot the fact that he had a lower IQ, and that, that some of the concepts that he was dealing with he may not have had a grasp on. But prison is prison. You put somebody away and ruin their life. He was married. He had children. He was living the life that he was proud of. He was involved in the family business, and have all of that torn away from you is unimaginable. And then, are you surprised with how upbeat he was when he came out?
He's a complicated character, like we all are. He was likable. You're right. I mean, he had a he became a folk hero for a reason, not just because he was the first wrongly convicted person, this victim of this horrible injustice that happened in the justice system, in an imperfect justice system, but his personality also helped. I mean, when he was interviewed by the media, and he loved and continued to love, as events unfolded, the media, he gave them good stuff, you know, and he was who he was. He'd be drinking a can of beer, or he'd show up and be filmed with the governor during the Avery Task Force after it was ready to be signed, wearing a T-shirt with a pizza stain on it, and there was the governor.
Michael, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue examining the Stephen Avery case, the first one that got him put away on a wrongful conviction. We'll do that next here on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Schrader, and I appreciate you joining us this evening as we take a look at Making a Murderer. The book that we're referring to tonight, The Innocent Killer, the author, Michael Griesbach, is here with us. He's a prosecuting attorney in the Wisconsin County where the events actually took place. And he's got a unique perspective on this story. Michael, there was a preponderance of false evidence that was put out there to make an innocent man seem guilty. Why would the government, why would the law enforcement, the judicial system, go out of their way at such a massive cost to their principles, to their own backings and everything to do something like this? I mean, that's part of what just totally boggles the mind. It'd be one thing if you have one vindictive cop doing something stupid, but this was a conspiracy. There were multiple people involved in this story to ruin this man's life.
Yeah, to me it comes down to three words. Lack of courage. And what I mean by that is they first thought, based upon the loosest of descriptions of the victim before they went into this further, and because of a bunch of things that came together in this perfect storm, those two things made them first think that it just must be Stephen Avery. It sounds like Stephen Avery. The problem is, and we can get into why they thought that, the problem is within a few days of that, at the latest, they came into other information, and this is, starts out with just two people, really, the sheriff and the deputy, the female deputy who responded to the hospital to talk to the victim. And after the victim, Penny Burnson, just told them it was a bearded man. She's still in the hospital, of course, bloodied, bruised, badly bruised, her face pulverized, broken bones, and of course they're interviewing her with good intent. They want to get the perpetrator soon. But she's still traumatized, and she gives a vague description. It was a sandy-haired man walking on the beach wearing dress shoes and a black leather coat. Mind you, it was about 82 degrees in a late July day in 1985 on Lake Michigan. That's the way the guy was dressed. He had a beard, and as I recall, she said something that doesn't really narrow things down much for men in this part of the state. He had a, quote, beer belly. So that's what the police had. But the first officer to show up was a new of Mr. Avery. In fact, she's featured on the show, I think. She did not like Mr. Avery. In fact, she couldn't stand Mr. Avery, and Mr. Avery was out on bail for this other crime that actually involved a victim who was a police officer's wife. So Avery had a lot of bad stuff going for him. And that officer jumped to the conclusion, it sure sounds like Stephen Avery. And then from there, it took on a life of its own. The sheriff, believing his female, young deputy female officer who cared so much, you know, who emoted so much about what happened to the victim, appropriately, in some way, but not in others. She wasn't a law enforcement. She wasn't acting like a police officer investigating. She was acting like a person, you and I, who would feel horrible for somebody with no training, thinking, oh, it must be this guy. So then they get the mugshot, and it goes on, and he's through a process that we'll go through in detail, I'm sure. All of a sudden, he becomes the suspect, and he's more or less, the victim is more or less manipulated into picking him out. And at that point, within a couple days, they knew that the guy they arrested after that identification, that suggestive manipulated identification, they came into information that it wasn't him. And they kept on going anyhow, and they had information that they knew it was the real guy. Why did they do it? Well, I'm kind of explaining part of it. They did it in part because they thought at first they had the real guy. But then the real question is, why did they not back up? Why didn't they say, hold the phone, put on the brakes, we got the wrong guy, we blew it, we moved too fast, we've got to dismiss it against this guy and refile against the right guy? You know, why didn't they do that? Why did they spend months in a jury trial, 3-4 day jury trial, 6 months later, arguing passionately that this guy was guilty, the district attorney, knowing, in my opinion, and I always have to say the Wisconsin Attorney General found otherwise, knowing that he was sending an innocent man to prison. Why did they do that? Well,
let's, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, what was that piece of information that they got that let them know that they had the wrong man in prison? We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. In the wrongful conviction case of Stephen Avery in 1985, Michael, what was the piece of information that the police got that proved that Stephen was the wrong guy? What did they find out?
A bunch of things somewhat gradually. The first one was telephone calls that Penny Burnson got, late night phone calls a day or two after continuing from who she thought was the perpetrator. You know, those calls like, I know where you are, where's Tom, from some voice she doesn't know who it was. Stephen Avery was locked up with no access to a call, phone on orders of the sheriff, yet Penny was still getting these calls. She even went over to the police agency with a detective from the police agency, Manitowoc City Police Department, which is different, told the sheriff, including Bergner, who had been following the city police department, the true assailant, said, look, it sounds like this guy, not Mr. Avery, not the sheriff, though. He said, nope, we got our guy. They soon got the alibis. They, of course, you know, they investigated by talking to all the witnesses, the Averys, hoping they can get other members of the family to pin this on Stephen. Instead, what they got within a couple days were stories from 16 or so different people. Sure, mostly family members, you know, of the Averys, but others who had an airtight alibi proved, essentially, including a clerk up at the Shopko in Green Bay with a receipt, where she recalls Mr. Avery and his family, his wife and five children, in the checkout line at a certain time, a specific time, I think it was 5:17 or 5:13 p.m., making it virtually impossible for Mr. Avery to have been the one to commit this crime, you know, and then drive up to Green Bay to be in the Shopko line. They knew that. Finally, the district attorney's staff, some people who were still in the DA's office when this all came to light in 2003, when he was exonerated, told me and later told the attorney general's office in their investigation that actually they knew, or they sure thought it was Mr. Allen, Gregory Allen, who had been in trouble earlier that summer for similar stuff, but never quite caught on the real serious stuff. They said, look, everything this woman, Penny Burnson, is saying sounds like Gregory Allen, Dennis, talking to the DA. Are you sure you got the right guy? In fact, remember you prosecuted Gregory Allen yourself for a similar incident on the same stretch of beach when he lunged at a woman a couple years earlier. In fact, the police called Gregory Allen the Sandman because he'd go down to this beach, that area anyhow, and try to assault people. The DA, and this'll get you, Dave, and you already know it, I think, but maybe it'll get your listeners, and it made me sick. The DA told his staff at the time, no, it could not be Gregory Allen. It wasn't him because I checked with Allen's probation agent, and his probation agent told me that he was at a certain location all day. Allen's got an airtight alibi. I can't, you know, it wasn't Allen, you guys. Well, the AG's report outlined and made clear that Mr. Allen wasn't even on probation at the time, much less have an alibi. So they knew. They knew. I don't know how they couldn't. I found the complaint where Mr. Dennis Vogel, the district attorney himself, had charged the true assailant, Gregory Allen, with lunging at a different woman and dropping his shorts on the same stretch of beach 2 summers earlier, almost to the day. And the woman received late-night phone calls from the perpetrator, just like Penny Burns had did. That was in the file. I came across that in the Avery file, which essentially proves, I think, along with everything else, that Vogel, the DA, and Kucerik, certainly, the sheriff, knew that they had the wrong guy pretty soon, pretty quickly on after they arrested Mr. Avery. Yet they did nothing.
All right. I want to talk about that aspect of it, because now that we know that Avery was cleared, and I know this is another part of the story for the next hour, but when he was cleared, while he was in court fighting for his life the second time and ended up taking a smaller settlement so that he would have money to retain good attorneys to help him in the second case, part of the agreement was that he was signing off that no further damages or anything would be done to the people involved, the law enforcement and the judicial system. That, right. A, seems like a crime to me. B, okay, so he doesn't file charges. Why does the law not step in and say, this is a miscarriage of justice? You knowingly and willingly hid information in a conspiratorial way. I mean, there should have been 8 or 10 different things filed on these gentlemen for the crime that they perpetrated. They were supposed to protect us and protect Stephen Avery and protect Penny and get the criminal put away. They went out of their way to fail every aspect. Why are they not being called in and arrested and imprisoned for that right now?
The crime misconduct in office comes to mind, doesn't it? Well, that's a good question, and that's why I called the Attorney General's report a whitewash. We took it to her just for that reason, to see if there were criminal or ethics violations on the part of the sheriff and the then district attorney. Her conclusion was, nope, no ethical or criminal law violations here, just strictly a lack of communication and failure to keep an open mind.
Really? So it wasn't a crime to say, oh yeah, I called his parole officer and he has an alibi, which is a lie. That's not miscommunication. Right. That is a bald-faced lie.
Right. The rest of which a regular person who said something like that to a police officer, even with lower stakes, would be charged with obstructing a police officer. According to the AG, that's not a crime. Not against law enforcement, not against a former DA and a former sheriff.
Why is it not taken above her head? And why is she not being held culpable for dismissing something that glaringly and embarrassingly wrong?
Well,
shouldn't this flow downhill and uphill? And when the people that are there to protect us, isn't that an even bigger crime in a sense? Because you're the ones that are there to protect us. You're the ones that are there to make things right. And if everybody is going to keep covering for everybody else, it should just keep going up. And then everybody that's involved in dismissing it and brushing it away, everybody should be held responsible.
Amen. Amen, brother. And we tried to do as much as we could. Now, I will say that, I am giving what is obviously my pretty firmly held belief, very firmly held belief about this. But I will say that I'm far from the only one, not just Avery's wrongful conviction lawsuit. Anybody who really looks at the facts of that underlying one, which is part of what my book is about, and really is objective and not trying to protect or blame people when it doesn't exist, I think come away from that thinking, believing, that what you're saying is true, and that they were not held accountable is one of the many tragedies of this whole thing. As part of the reason why I wrote the book, Dave, because of the murder, you see, they were about to be held accountable. They were personally sued, in that lawsuit. It was Stephen Avery and his wrongful conviction lawsuit, Stephen Avery versus Manitowoc County, Manitowoc County's insurance carrier, and Dennis Vogel, the DA, in his personal capacity, and Thomas Kucerik, the sheriff, in his personal capacity. It was a $36 million lawsuit. A lot of zeros, but even if...
Right, but was that a civil lawsuit or a criminal lawsuit?
It was civil, but it would have bankrupted them at the least. And we took it to the Attorney General, and that would have been whatever criminal investigation. Now, when do you cross the line, you know, as a law enforcement? When should they be charged? How good does the evidence have to be? Et cetera, et cetera. That would be what you'd look at. But in this case, the AG totally dropped the ball. I think it was a political, you read the facts and you're disgusted in this 18-page Attorney General report, but then you read the last two pages or the last two paragraphs, the conclusion, and it's clear it was almost written by someone else. The dissonance is so clear. The politicos got a hold of it and whitewashed it. And, you know, I hadn't thought of or still can't think of, really, other than, you know, and I don't know if it does any good at this point to take it to the next step, which, you know, Mr. Avery had great lawyers in his civil lawsuit. Is this thing where the federal authorities look at and reopen what happened that many years ago? I don't know.
Are you surprised that with the popularity of this documentary series, there hasn't been more pressure from the federal government to step in and say, hold on? It's time to hold people, especially most of those guys are now out of the loop and no longer practicing. Why not take them to task now?
I'm going to be perfectly honest. You're the first person that has thought through that far, as far as those particular guys. The focus now is completely on, you know, it's the current guys that set them up again that we'll talk about. And that's
right.
One
and
of the sins.
Allegedly. Allegedly set him up.
Exactly.
Right. We got to be careful,
exactly.
Counselor. Let me ask.
Counselor's going to weigh in on that because that's a bunch of baloney, I think. The latest allegation.
Let me ask you about this then. You're still there.
Yes.
I'm telling you, after doing the show tonight from my state of Minnesota, knowing I have to go visit my family in Illinois and drive through Wisconsin, I can guarantee you I'll be driving 5 miles under the limit, and I will not stop in Manitowoc County at all for any reason, and if my tire blows out, I will carry my car to the next block. But how is it that you're there practicing law, you're involved in that environment, and writing a book outing these people? Are you ever worried about, being railroaded?
I'll tell you this. The cops had my book, The Innocent Killer, for 6 months. They had it in their break room, Manitowoc City Police Department, not the Sheriff's Department. And they read it. And I can't tell you how many officers came up and said, Mike, thanks for writing that. I mean, thanks a lot, because really, and they were genuine about it. First of all, it's really an interesting read. They're reading about their own area. But second of all, they're disgusted by what their predecessors did. By at least, you know, and it's not everybody. It was the sheriff, maybe a handful of cops who circled the wagons and the DA. And regular people, and you started the show out this way, Dave, most police officers, whatever percent, 90%, most district attorneys, I mean, there's occupational hazards, the arrogance and the power goes to people's heads, but they're mostly good people that would never do anything like this. So they like the book. What's it like, though? It's a little weird right now. It's a little weird. and we can go into that later. But I'm not too worried about the cops. I'm worried about some threats I'm getting from people who are convinced that somehow, even though I wrote the book outing the prior people here, that because I take the position that they did not set up the Avery this time and that Avery is guilty this time, because I take that position, I'm either a, quote, this is from an email recently, an utter fool, which I can live with, or I'm in on it too. And that hits close to home. You know, I wasn't out planting evidence. Didn't happen.
And so we're going to discuss a lot of that in the next hour of the show, because we've talked about the first case, and it's glaringly obvious, and as a matter of fact, so obvious they let him go. They know who the real perpetrator was. I'm still not 100% on why he hasn't been charged and how there can be a statute of limitations on a violent sexual predator crime when he continues to do it. You know, it'd be one thing if it was, and understand, I'm not trying to be dismissive because I don't want women mad at me around the world. If it was a one-off case, maybe you say, okay, that was past the statute of limitations, but when it's a continued ongoing situation, as you stated at the beginning of the show, it shouldn't be dismissed because he never learned from the lesson. He couldn't say it was a one-time got in over my head situation. This is something that he has continued to do. Why are they not prosecuting, and why does it not go back?
Oh, believe me, I'd love to charge him with the old one, but that was an attempted murder that happened in 1985. For murder, there is no statute of limitations. For sex assaults, although there's some varying ones depending on child sex assault and how old you are now, but for this one, when the woman was an adult in 1985, the statute of limitations has kicked in. I also spoke with Penny, the victim of that first one, Penny Burnson, who wrote a postscript in my book, and we talked about it a lot, and even trying to battle the statute of limitations issue, she wasn't interested in doing that. The good news, Dave, is that guy's going nowhere. He's in prison in Wisconsin after being convicted in Green Bay of the one he committed 10 years after he assaulted Penny Burnson.
All right, we're up against the top of the hour break. Michael Griesbach, our guest. When we come back, we're going to talk about the second conviction. And the documentary paints a pretty compelling picture that Stephen Avery was again railroaded. Our guest might have a different perspective. We'll take a look at all angles of this case tonight on Coast to Coast AM.